Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and today I get to talk with Ross McPhee, a paleo mammologist. And I have so many questions. Hello, Ross.
Hello, Dennis. Nice to speak with you.
Oh, where are you at this current time? Let's give a little bit of context of where we are. We're at the 3rd of April, 2020, and you are physically where in the world? I'm in Austin, Texas.
I'm in upstate New York. I work in the city, but as everyone knows, there is a little bit of a problem right now. So I've been self-isolating up here for the last several weeks.
I'm so glad that you're safe and that you're taken care of. What do you sense globally, that there is something shifting here as it has shifted at different times over the course of humanity, then pre-humanity, and then the world? Is your scientific sense that something big and important and culturally important is going on now?
Well, yes, but of course we're only going to really understand that retrospectively, some months, perhaps years out. What I'm hoping in this country is that it's finally realized that things like, I don't want to get political too much, but I do want to say this, the things like wealth disparity are things we have to face up to, especially access, like right now, to medical care. And I'm hoping that if we have that kind of sea change, it's going to work out so that we're even better off than they were beforehand. Obviously, we're going through an economic crisis. That's unavoidable. But there is the other side, and I hope to see all of us on the other side living better lives.
I do, too. And that is because I'm wired optimistic. I'm 71 this year, and I'm finding that I'm doing the absolute best work of my life. And please, I tell you this as your elder cousin. Do not believe anything that they say about aging, because I am having the time of my life doing the absolute best work I have ever done. I'm more curious. I have a more beginner's mind than I've ever had.
I feel the same way, but I do need to take issue with you on whether you're my elder. If you were born before January 17, 1949, then okay. Otherwise,
I am.
It's mine.
April the 17th. I was April the 17th, 1948. So I am just right in that range. So tell me
okay.
First of all, let's talk about a paleo mammologist and what that means. Give me a contextual so that I understand what that is.
Okay, I think everybody knows the word paleontology, study of life of the past. I'm specifically working in the large area called vertebrate paleontology, so animals with backbones. And paleomammalogy is concerned really exclusively with mammals and their closest relatives. So that's what I do.
Right.
I work with the evolution of mammals, trying to understand what happened, when, what were they like, what happened to them, all of these kinds of questions that are of interest.
Well, let me ask you a question, because this is something this is Dennis's, and this is one of the things, Ross, I really need you to do, is to push back at me when my understanding conflicts with what you understand or the science. So please help me.
No worries.
Stop me right there. Okay, so here's my place that I want to know. Dinosaurs are all over. There is some type of and mammals are these little scurrying creature. Whatever it is some little scurrying minor kind of a creature somewhere around in the that ran around the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs, for whatever reason, they don't go extinct. They evolve into birds, of course. But then suddenly the mammals go, it's our time, and that is, and that began the age of mammals, and mammals began to be there. How close am I to understanding what happened?
You're very close, but there are some words I would use, and the chief one is ecology and ecological relationships. It's kind of a black box right now as to exactly what happened to dinosaurs, and incidentally, about 75% of all vertebrate taxa that were living at that time. They disappeared, yes, except for the lineages that yielded birds, but exactly what went on, how fast it went on, why did mammals manage to survive and others didn't? These are questions that some very good minds have been applying themselves to for several decades, even more than that, without any clear answer at this point. But from a different perspective, I think we can understand it. Dinosaur ecological relationships, even though we focus perhaps in movies and so on the big meat eaters like the tyrannosaurs and so forth.
Sure.
It was vastly more complex than that. There were dinosaurs, real dinosaurs, that were chicken-sized, and then there were, of course, ones that were the size of several elephants. But
sure.
In between all of that, there was also probably a much greater diversity in where they could live and how they lived that we could possibly reconstruct from the fossil record as we now understand it. There were certainly
yes.
herbivores. Everybody knows about duckbills, for example. These guys were not chewing on meat. They were herbivores. There were probably ones that were either actually living in the ground. We call those fossorial or something
right.
like that. And they probably lived on small invertebrates. Just like you can find kind of their ecological equivalents among mammals today and birds. So what happened was that there had to be something very fundamental to those networks that collapsed. And the reason why the impactor hypothesis, the idea that a comet or an asteroid hit the Earth about 66 million years ago, the reason why that is largely favored by paleontologists is because it provides the kind of disaster that's needed to absolutely change the planet, to interfere
yeah.
with so many ecological relationships that the only likely outcome for most of them was extinction.
Wow. So that, all right, so that happens, however it happens. Then we get the rise of the mammals and the diversity. It's just, evolution absolutely fascinates me. I mean, to see how we evolve and what happens. And so these mammals begin to evolve and diversify, right? And then.
Well, go ahead.
Tell me. No. You.
Well, one of the things that is important to understand from the fossil record as we now have it, this is something that has really become apparent only in the last 20 years or so, is that we think of the age of mammals beginning at the end of the age of dinosaurs 66 million years ago. But that's really not the case. Mammals, not very closely related to us, but by definition mammals, were
mm-hmm.
around at least 125 million years ago. So we're already
Holy
back
Christmas.
Into the Jurassic at that point. And they were different from any of the mammals that came later. Some of them were not merely tiny and scurrying. They were all comparatively small, but by no means, you know, mouse or shrew-sized, all of them. Now,
sure.
they came and went, different groups of these mammals. They had their own periods of success and loss. The thing that sort of enabled our kind of mammals, and here I'm talking about placental mammals in particular, but also marsupials. Those are the two major groups
mm-hmm.
that survived. All of the others went. They went down either with the dinosaurs or close thereafter. So it was not an exclusive kind of club. The mammals suffered as well. In some
sure.
way, these ecological collapses that I'm talking about opened up niches or the possibilities for placental and marsupial mammals that didn't exist beforehand, or there were dinosaurs and other kinds of vertebrates that were already occupying them and they were just better at it, but they didn't
wow.
make the cut. And having them out of the picture kind of seemingly unleashed the possibilities for animals like us. Once again, exactly what happened, how it happened. These are more black box problems. It's not to say there aren't theories,
Absolutely.
but they're very difficult to demonstrate just from fossils and the kinds of records that we have.
From what I understand, Ross, and help me if I understand this, that just the fact that there is an actual fossil is like a miracle. I mean, to have all the things that have to go right in order for a fossil to happen is a very, very long odds just to be able to get it to be there.
That is totally correct. You know, when I talk to people in formal groups about my field work, they say, oh, well, how many skeletons of mastodons and mammoths and so on have you found? And my answer is almost none, because most fossils are terribly torn up. They're just bits and pieces. It's extremely rare to find anything that's terribly intact. And it's just as you're saying, Dennis, it is almost a miracle that anything survives. The way to think about it, I guess, is, when you leave your lunch out on the lawn or something, somebody is going to come by for it. It's going to be up in this part of the country. It's going to be a little possum or something of that. They're going to snag it and take it off, and that's that, right? So you have to think the same way about animals dying, for example, out on the range. Not only are there things that are going to feed on them, but there's rain, there's snow, there's temperature change, all of these things, sunlight, all of these are very tough on bone, which is why, again, it's almost a miracle that anything survives. What really has to happen for really good preservation is that things get immediately trapped in a place where not much can happen to them.
Yeah.
So one of the things I did early in my career was to work a lot in caves, because caves, from this perspective, are nature's garbage can. Anything that gets into the cave and can't get out again, well, it's going to be there for you to find thousands of years later, and probably mostly intact, because there aren't that many things that live in caves that are really tough on fossils.
Wow. And all right, so you went. Let me, since we talked a little bit historically, I want to go back to your thoughts as a child and as a teenager and as a person going to college. When did this impelling of wanting to study and get into science and do this happen for you, Ross? And where were you?
Well, so I grew up in Western Canada in Edmonton, Alberta, mm-hmm. and I started college there. And this is going to seem very weird to you because you're talking
Good.
To somebody
Good.
Who features himself as a scientist today. But I made up my mind very early that what I really wanted to be was a professor of history. I was very interested in comparatively recent history, 18th, 19th century, in places like Africa with the rise of colonialism, questions like that.
Sure.
So I was already committed to the humanities. That's what I wanted. So I took languages, I took history courses, all of this kind of thing. But at my university, the University of Alberta, when I started out in my freshman year, they required that you take a science. So I was looking through the course catalog, and there were these courses in chemistry and physics, which I had assiduously avoided, except at the level of necessary qualifications for getting my high school diploma. And none of this looked very attractive. So in the end, I had two choices. One was to do a class in entomology, because I'd always been interested in insects in one way or another. The other was to take a course, an upper-level course, in physical anthropology, having to do, of course, with human evolution and bones and this sort of thing. And I can't really give you an objective reason for this, other than I thought, that course, that's going to be easier than entomology, so I'm going to do that. And what I didn't expect was how fascinated I would be by things like bones and teeth, about fossils, about preservation, all of these kinds of issues that we've just talked about, the fossil record. So I had to do a fairly rapid retooling, since I was aimed in a completely different direction, and that's what I ended up with. and got my PhD years later, also at the University of Alberta, and have subsequently worked on mammal evolution and related things, a little bit of archaeology, a little bit of human evolution, all of these kinds of things that for me are all inextricably related as scientific problems as to what happened in the past, how it happened.
And I'm going to add to that my experience and what I have talked with scientists and around the world, that your investment in the humanities deeply informs and deeply enriches all of your scientific work.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I don't regret any of it, right? It's just that light bulb went on, as happens in one's life in many different kinds of circumstances. And I said, yeah, this is what fits. This is what I want to do.
Yeah. It's just when I think of this, we've had on the show some astrophysicists and cosmologists and want to have more, but the idea of life, just this life and how it evolves and how it absolutely fascinates me. And your particular, the one of the slices that you did when you decided to write this book, The End of Megafauna, The Fate of the World's Hugest, Fiercest, and Strangest Animals, that please, and I encourage anyone, look right on the console, and you can click right there in order to buy the book and to get it. But when you decided to write the book, what was your origin thoughts to do this?
Well, I had been interested for many years in what has happened to the natural world since modern Homo sapiens arose. And one of the and this will be very familiar to everyone, because basically we're a disaster as far as the rest of the planet goes. But there was no standing.
Yeah, that's us. We're humans.
Yes, go on. And therefore everything has to kneel before us. Yes, I get it. The thing I got interested in was a particular class of problems which had to do with human-induced extinctions, which is another thing that everybody understands now because it's everywhere. What I'm talking about, however, is something that happened fairly early in our species history, back in the Pleistocene, so more than 10,000 years ago, up to about 2.5 million years ago.
Right.
And the very influential argument by a paleoecologist at the University of Arizona, Paul Martin, was that there's a pattern to the losses that we can actually say something about. And that pattern seems to be repeated again and again, which is what gives the argument strength, right?
Yeah.
That everything is going along just fine for the animals concerned. And by animals, I mean not only mammals, but birds and lizards and other vertebrates. Everything goes along fine until the first humans show up. So the way to think about this, Homo sapiens, paleontologists seem to agree that Homo sapiens arose first in Africa, maybe around 300,000 years ago. And I'm talking specifically about our species as opposed to earlier kines of Homo.
Yeah,
Right. So we got out of Africa, we got into Europe and Asia, and then progressed from there once skills like building boats and being able to take long-distance travel came along. We eventually got to all the world's habitable islands. And what Paul pointed out, which absolutely blew my mind, was that there was this pattern where suddenly, when humans arrive, there's a faunal catastrophe in case after case. What his big contribution here was to link this apparent pattern with radiocarbon dating. The thing to understand about radiocarbon dating is you can date pretty well anything that has carbon in it, that has carbon produced by living organisms.
Right.
And its precision has gained rapidly since it was first developed back in the early 1950s.
Wonder.
So within reason, you can date an object, a historical or prehistoric object, to within a space of a few decades, probabilistically, as to when the organism died, or the source of carbon was no longer alive, is a better way to put that. So what he established over time was that not only was the pattern there, but it was almost like going from night to day, or from probably from day to night, and from the way the animals would have looked at it. People show up, and the catastrophe follows on within decadal or at most centennial kinds of kinds of intervals. Okay, so that's the overarching pattern, and I learned about that very early back in my freshman year once again, and I guess it just sort of stayed with me that this is a puzzle that needs further investigation from the point of view of the scientific causes, right? So to what degree were humans complicit? Did they do something else that resulted in these collapses, or was it all due to overhunting, which is Paul's point of view?
Yeah.
So when I finished my PhD, which was in a very different area, that was in embryology, just to show you that I've been around the block several times.
Yay.
I started getting very interested in having my own expeditions for recovering fossils in various places, which might shed some light on what went on. And what I was interested in, because I thought this was a decisive sort of way to test Paul's ideas, was to go to islands where we know that faunal collapses had occurred and to see what the evidence was like there as opposed to continents. And there's a good reason for doing islands, because islands, obviously, if you're dealing with terrestrial organisms, they're very confined spaces. So it shouldn't take too long, accordingly, if humans were doing something like overhunting, to wipe out lots of species quite expeditiously. So I wanted to see what that looked like. And because island occupation by humans happened fairly late in our career, it's within radiocarbon time. Radiocarbon time is about the last 50,000 years. After about 50,000 years, there's too little carbon, at least with measurement methods that we have now, to get accurate dating. So I needed things that were fairly recent. And where I started working was Madagascar, which had a very large series of extinctions affecting things like lemurs and giant birds and so on.
And this is right off the eastern coast, lower eastern coast of Africa?
Right. It's the world's fourth largest island. It's been separated from Africa for at least 150 million years, but mammals managed to get there. And there's plenty of mammals even now that are not represented anywhere else on the planet. It had sort of its own isolation history.
How
then people
cool.
showed up maybe 2,000 years ago, and suddenly... Excuse me. Suddenly there were all of these losses. And by all of these losses, I mean things like giant lemurs, lemurs the size of gorillas, elephant birds, as they were known, which are four times the size of ostriches. All of the big guys went, very few of the smaller ones. And that is another part of this pattern, that it was the megafauna, the animals that we estimate weighed about 100 pounds or more, that preferentially disappeared. Smaller animals managed to glide through, for the most part, in most places. And what I found was that in Madagascar and also the West Indies, where I worked subsequently, was that the pattern once again held true, that it was the larger animals that disappeared. But what was puzzling was what humans did, because there is no evidence, or no evidence that I personally accept, of indications of overhunting. There's really no indications even of hunting in most of these places. So is it really right to blame these extinctions specifically on overhunting by humans, or was something else involved? And that took me into a byway, which I guess at the present moment, since we're concerned about coronavirus, will seem very prescient on our part. So in the end, it didn't work out terribly well as an argument. This was the idea that it was not what humans specifically did, it's what they carried with them. And here the idea is by carrying infectious organisms, pathogens, into places where they hadn't been previously introduced, that you had massive fatality.
Absolutely.
There were a number of assumptions involved in this argument, which I called the hyperdisease argument with my collaborator, Preston Marks, who is an AIDS expert, as a matter of fact, so very attuned to what happens with the emerging diseases. And it was really a thought experiment, because at the end of the day, we didn't have any evidence that is worth talking about for it. But the idea is that we had these problems. Why did the big guys disappear? Why was it so fast? What did it have to do with humans, if anything? And we were trying to cobble together arguments that would make it appear that disease could have been the efficient cause. So let's look at this.
Yeah.
One of the things about big mammals, and this applies to humans, is that they have a very low rate of natural increase per individual. It's unusual, especially nowadays, for females to have more than one or two children, at least in the Western world. But even in the past,
yes,
it was not common to have a very large progeny. You might have 10 kids during your lifetime, but only a proportion of them would survive. And unlike smaller mammals, which would have, say, 10 offspring per breeding season, there's no comparison.
No.
Let's look at elephants for a minute. So mammoths were elephants. They're very closely related to Asian elephants. And if we use that as an index, Asian elephants go for about 22 to 24 months per pregnancy. So even though you might live a very long time, you're not going to have a lot of living offspring by the end of your life. It's just the way it is. This is almost a rule in ecology that the larger you are, the fewer offspring you have, even if you have a longer lifespan.
Yeah.
So whatever did these megafauna in, if it hit the birth cycle specifically in some specific way, so that was very badly interrupted, it would take a long time for the species to recover, measured in years. And if it was repeated, if it kept emerging year after year over a long period of time, then that could devastate big mammals in particular, perhaps to the point that they actually started going extinct. So could that be part of it? We wondered about that. Now, what would make emerging diseases particularly interesting in this regard? And let me here give you the example of measles.
Yeah.
For people who have an ancestry that's largely European, measles are almost never a problem, meaning that your children are not going to die from it, nor as an adult, if you get it, are you going to die from it. And a good reason for thinking that is that when measles first emerged, which was probably tens of thousands of years ago, it's not really estimated at this point, it was probably highly lethal, just as it is, or just as it particularly was, when Europeans started coming to the New World. Among many of the bad things that Europeans did at this time was to introduce a range of infectious diseases. We've heard about smallpox, and that's still a serious disease for humans, but nobody would really think about measles being a particular problem, or typhus, or cholera, but all of these diseases of varying degrees of mortality were introduced at roughly the same time. And one estimate is, and this is, of course, based on many assumptions, but one estimate is that 90% of Aboriginal populations in the New World disappeared within a few hundred years of the arrival of Europeans 500 years ago. So when you start conjuring with ideas like this, you can see, okay, maybe there is something to this disease argument. The problem, however, in the end, was not that disease could not cause extinction. I think in some cases it probably has. It's what you do about the fact that, say, in North America, where we had 70 species disappear at roughly the same time, maybe within 400 years of one another or less, what you have to imagine is that the disease or diseases were capable of jumping all over the place, affect nearly everything. And we've never seen a disease process like that. Right now, people with corona, now that we're talking about or thinking about coronavirus, what's emerged in the last few days is that maybe cats, possibly even dogs, could get coronavirus. So that would be an example of coronavirus jumping, in this case, from human hosts to pets. But in our domestic animals, it's probably not going to cause any level of mortality, because the invasive organism is just not that well adapted to a cat or a dog environment, unlike with us, apparently. With us, it seems to transfer with extreme ease, which is why it's an international problem. There's apparently not a country on the planet now that doesn't have some signs of infection. But to go across the whole board of all species living at that time, so all of your elephants, your mastodons, your saber-toothed cats, giant sloths, giant beavers, all the rest of it, to imagine that they all succumbed at roughly the same time from roughly the same disease or diseases. This is when my colleague said, Ross, forget about it. It doesn't make sense. But the reason for going down that particular rabbit hole was to come up with an alternative explanation for how it could be that humans were on the scene but apparently weren't doing all that much to cause all of these losses. This is a paradox. And how could it happen so quickly with very small numbers of people, say, coming into North America 16,000 years ago or so? It could not have been the case that they were everywhere at once, so that they were taking down every last sloth or every last mammoth. There had to be other processes going on. And the new kid on the block, which I am very favorably inclined towards, is that perhaps it was just like with the dinosaurs. It was a big impactor, maybe about 12,500 years ago, which set in motion a whole number of ecological collapses, and that's the reason why the extinction picture looks the way it does. So it keeps on going. These are all historical problems. It's like trying to figure out why Napoleon was ultimately a failure. You can come up with many arguments. There's lots of documentation, this, that, and the next thing. You should never have tried to take on the Russians. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, what you've got are arguments that are more or less plausible, more or less well-supported with, in this case, historical evidence, but prehistoric in my case, and you're trying to build the best house of cards you can.
Yeah.
Does it make any difference to the course of human welfare? Well, probably not, except that we do need to understand about what it is that we do in environments all over the planet causing extinction right now, because most of those effects really are quite indirect when you think about it in opposition to overhunting. There's not that much overhunting that goes on, but there is despoilation everywhere with the destruction of forests, with pollution, with our anthropogenically induced global warming. You can go on and on.
Yes.
It's things that we do without understanding. This is the problem. We're like the vicious child who gets bored with his toys, and so he starts destroying them indiscriminately, and then asks, well, how did this happen? He said, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, all right, let's take that as an analogy and help me to understand if this analogy holds. If we are a relatively young species, or at least in Homo sapien part, or even in hominids, 3 million white or some odd years, that's relatively young, isn't it? We would still be in our young childhood. As far as our development, do I have an? Am I saying that in a way that is all scientifically valid?
I'm not sure that the youth of the species is the important factor. The important factor, now thinking of ourselves as humans, is the degree to which, of course, culture made us what we are today, as the dominant species on the planet. But what culture has not been able to deal with, even though we would like it to, is all of our I'm trying to remember the book, the Naked Ape, right?
Yeah.
From Paul Desmond.
Right, Desmond ago. Morris?
Desmond Morris, correct.
I can't believe I remember that. I don't know where that word. Do you ever do that word?
My boy, you're 71 years old, just like I.
Well, I know. And it just popped into my head. I don't know. Go ahead.
So the argument there was that we have deep within our sort of lizard brains all of these things that we haven't come to grips with. We haven't come to grips with intra-species aggression. This is why we have wars and violence. And all of that kind of thing. So, you know, you can say, well, culture should be a moderating influence, and it is. I Don't argue that. But it hasn't made that kind of difference. It hasn't turned us into something radically different from what our roots are.
Yeah. All right. Couple of things that I want to go. How does assuming that there was some kind of a catastrophic event that happened like 12,500 years ago or whatever, would that be like a huge volcanic eruption that completely got, would it be some combination of what kinds of things? How do you follow that trail that we might learn that?
Okay, so there's two sides to this. There's what I call the empirical side, which has to do with the evidence for the impactor. And once again, I'm talking about an asteroid or comet, probably a comet in this case, hitting the planet. How do we know that? What's that based on? Is it just a hoax, or do I have something that I can actually back this up with? The second part is the interpretive, speculative part, which is what would that impact have caused that could have made such a difference in such a short period of time in the places where it did? Okay, so let's go to the empirical part of this first of all. What the impactor 66 million years ago, what gave that particular strength as a hypothesis was not the idea that you have these extraterrestrial bodies hitting the planet. That happens all the time. Mm-hmm. It still happens. The meteorites are tiny by comparison to what I'm talking about. So that wasn't the big deal. What happened was that investigators noted that there was a very strange anomaly, as we call it, an unexpected thing, in the sedimentary record right around 66 million years ago. And without going into absurd detail on this, what I want to point out was, why did they think that there was an impactor of very large size which hit the planet at this time?
Sure.
It's called the iridium anomaly. Iridium is an element, and it's in the platinum group of elements.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very rare on Earth, at least in the superficial part of Earth where we live. So if you find a big spike in something like these rare Earths, you have to account for it. And the only way that it seemed plausible to account for it was that a meteorite chock full of iridium, as they sometimes are, hit the planet, and that's the reason for the anomaly. But what they also saw was that this anomaly occurred at the same time all over the planet where you had sediments of this age that were decently preserved, that you could find the same anomaly. So that was weird. It's like the only way of explaining this, to go down the same trail of argument, is that not only the impactor bring in the rare earth, that that's sort of its fingerprint, but that it must have been of colossal size in order to distribute its particles all over the planet.
Everywhere.
So then they started modeling. What do you need for size? Because they didn't have a crater to begin with. It was not known where it could have impacted. What could have happened, depending on the dimensions, depending on the speed that it hit the planet and the instantaneous transfer of energy? This is the way to think about this, is that when an object traveling thousands of kilometers a second impacts a planet like this, it's the transfer of energy is so incredibly large that physical particles become a plasma, a superheated plasma. So the idea was that with this terrific release of energy, you could have ignited worldwide forest fires, that there would have been infrared radiation going off in all directions, igniting fires all over the planet, which is an unbelievable thing even to contemplate. But with the impactor, again, depending on size, it would send up tremendous amounts of sediments from wherever it hit that would travel right into the stratosphere and be redistributed across the planet, perhaps on a scale so large that it would have shut down photosynthesis all over the planet. So now we're getting, into very dramatic territory. We've got fires everywhere. We've got We've got the possibility of photosynthesis being shut down. And then on top of that, depending on the chemical reactions that are going on by virtue of this plasma, you're also getting very dangerous gases being produced, like
sure.
Sulfur oxide, sulfur dioxide, which are very highly poisonous to animals like us. So it's sort of like a perfect storm of catastrophes spreading out over the planet. When the crater was eventually discovered, this is now in the early 90s, it was found to have impacted just offshore present-day Yucatan. It wouldn't have looked
right.
like that 66 million years ago. But that made a lot of sense because of all kinds of other things that finally seem to be resolvable. Why is Texas covered with particular kinds of sediments? Not just Texas, but going all the way up, almost up to the northern tier of
yeah.
the states. It's because of tsunamis that were unleashed by this impactor that carry these sediments that distance, which again is almost impossible to conceive, the amount of energy transfer that would be necessary to do this. Anyway, so on and on and on. I know I'm going at great length, but now I want to go back to the impactor at 12,500. The reason why that date is important is because prior to that, between about 18,000 and 12,500, we were already coming out of the last ice age. The ice was very rapidly retreating. The earth was warming up again. Animals were able to live in places where they hadn't lived for tens of thousands of years, like in central Canada, which prior to that in the ice age was covered by a huge ice cap. Suddenly at 12,500, and we know it was sudden, we know this from pollen studies, which showed
yeah.
the warming trend and the advance of plants, more temperate plants into the northern part of the continent. Suddenly all of that was cut off and we're back to tundra virtually overnight. So something real bad happened. The only way that we can think of this now is that it had to have interfered with the way in which thermal energy is distributed over the planet, which is largely through the oceans. It's not so much the atmosphere, it's through the oceans. The oceans carry
yeah.
a tremendous heat load, and thanks to the Gulf Stream, to talk about this continent, thanks to the Gulf Stream,
mm-hmm.
we get redistribution of tropical waters all the way up our east coast, and then it trends over the North Atlantic, keeping places like Britain warm, even though they're at very high latitude, relatively speaking. If it wasn't for the Gulf Stream, Britain would still be a tundra. So having that possibly interrupted by this tremendous impactor so that it shut down the heat circulation, changed the conveyor belt, which is, I'm not going to go there. This is too complicated to need to explain at this point. The way to imagine it is that there was interference with oceanic circulation. And that's what brought the temperature right back to the ice age in central and northern North America. So there is the beginning of the perfect storm envisaged by the 12,500 impactor. If with such rapid chilling, species that were just beginning to kind of re-expand from the remnants that were left in the southern part of North America, with this kind of impact, changing things so rapidly in such a short period of time, again, because we're talking about megafauna, remember, very low rate of natural increase, that would have impacted
yeah.
in the same way that I was talking about with the disease.
And because you interrupt the burst cycles, and so that's the perfect way to get rid of a species, because just in that way.
Exactly. So you can see why
that's
on this particular disaster.
Light
bulbs that are well worked out, much more so than with the disease hypothesis. There's not only the impactor at 66 million, but there are others in the fossil record that have been recognized as being correlated with losses either in the seas or in the land. So it seems to be a regular kind of process. And, you know, we've ducked the bullets that are hitting us right now, the very small ones, and these small meteorites
yep.
are not making any kind of difference. But there's some big guys out there that,
oh yeah,
you know, if we just have the wrong orbital parameters, we're not
exactly
going to be happy units in a while. Same thing.
No. And that is what we're, well, all right. So in this last 15 minutes that we have of that, I could talk with you for weeks. But in this last 15 minutes, what is your curiosity? What are you researching? What are you thinking about? What are you looking to disprove about what you think might have happened in your own scientific mind? What are the things that are burbling up at the edges of your thought that you're curious about?
So here's the tragedy, Dennis. Because I'm 71 years old, I'm not at the top of my game anymore. And the way advances are going to be made are in sciences whereof I wot not. For example, with the impactor, this is not just a question of being able to point to a disaster that might have had all of these implications, because what you want
sure.
is all the empirical evidence that you can get. So that means really your cosmological buddies are the ones who are going to make the advances here, because they're going to be able to model this thing. It's also not known. I should have said this. It's not known where the crater is. There is a candidate in northern Greenland. It's called the Hiawatha structure. It certainly looks like an impactor, but the trouble is it's thousands of feet under the ice.
Right.
So they are trying to remote sense. They're trying to drill down to it, find out what was going on and so forth. But its age has not been well constrained. It could be very young, like 12,500, but it could be very much older, in which case it's irrelevant to these very recent extinctions. There's no other candidates right now, but there is the same pattern, and this is something else that I need to mention at this point. This rare earth anomaly business, this is also applicable to the 12,500 impactor. There's a number of very well-trained geologists who've gotten interested in this problem, and they've been sampling, again, all over the planet, and the pattern is there. These rare earths are showing up in places as distant as southern Chile, throughout North America, over in Europe. So this seems to be kind of a lesser version of the Chicxulub impactor, as it's called, the one that hit the planet 66 million years ago.
Right.
Which may explain other things. You see, Dennis, when you get me started, I'm just going to go down another rabbit hole.
Oh, I love it. I see, this is the thing that I love
important.
About it.
Okay, so hang on to your seat. What Paul Martin's idea, here is a problem that Paul Martin faced with his overkill hypothesis, which is very relevant to our understanding of what happened 12,500 years ago. The problem that he had was that although the overkill argument made a certain amount of sense for North and South America, because we know that humans didn't live here prior to maybe 16,000 years ago or so.
Yeah.
The problem he had was that in Africa, almost nothing happened. There were a few losses, but nothing on the scale of dozens and dozens of species as in North and South America. So here's what Paul had to say about it. His argument was that since Homo sapiens evolved in Africa over a very lengthy period, overhunting really never took off. It was an arms race, as we like to describe it. As human technology for hunting got better, the animals got smarter. So in the end, humans, of course, hunted, but they didn't hunt it to the point of extinction of their prey species. Whereas elsewhere on the planet, where humans had never been resident before, when the humans showed up, the animals didn't know what to make of them. So it was easy, accordingly, for the humans to overhunt in those circumstances.
Yeah.
Now, I never thought that was a strong argument, Paul's argument about Africa being fairly immune to overkill and the reason for it. And the thing that's important, therefore, about the impactor argument is that it gives us a different way of thinking about Africa and South Asia, which also suffered no or very few losses at this point. And that has to do with the distribution of the apparent rare earth anomalies over the planet. They're mostly situated in North America. They do go down to southern Chile, which makes sense, as we'll see in a minute, and also in Western Europe. But thereafter, it just seems to attenuate. So one conclusion you can make is that if there was an impact of 12,500, it was not on the scale of the one that hit the Earth 66 million years ago. It had a reduced effect. And that reduced effect is probably the explanation for why North and South America were badly affected. If it hit in such a way that it interrupted the distribution of thermal energy, and we don't know exactly how that might have happened, but let's allow it as an argument, you got this sudden return in Europe and in North America, and to a lesser degree in Southern South America, of ice age-like conditions. So something really big absolutely happened at 12,500. If there was an impactor, and it had impactor-like effects, somewhat resembling those found in Chicxulub at 66 million, then we can envisage the case that it so changed so rapidly the local ecologies that the big mammals in particular were not able to recover. I go back to the argument that big mammals have this sort of inbuilt defect when it comes to populating the planet, which is they don't make enough of themselves quickly enough to replace the species if something very bad happens. So the argument would be, accordingly, that whatever this impactor did, it brought us back into a mini ice age, which only lasted for 1,000 years, I might add, and then we got warmer again.
Wow.
So it was a transitory effect, but it was bad enough at the time that it happened to take out species all over the Americas, which is the astounding thing.
All right. Well, here is the thing that I've got so many questions, Ross. I have to tell you one of the things that
you're
I love about having this conversation with you is that when Thomas Friedman, the economist, he talked about the important jobs of the 21st century and what they are. And one of them that he had, the classification is called the Great Explainers. And one of the things that I love about talking with you is that you explain things in a way that I can grasp them. And you make that science to English translation from the deep data, from the work that you're doing. And you really worked on that. You've really done that well. That's something that is beautiful in you. And I deeply appreciate it as a non-scientist, but someone who is science curious. And I want to know more about you're welcome. And one of the things I'd like to talk about in a future time, if you'll give me the opportunity to talk about it, I'd like to talk about this thing called humans and how we, what we know about us and what we don't know about us, and how we as mammals, because we're one of the large mammals, right? I mean, we're one of
we're megafauna
that are part of that. We're a mega mammal, and so how that works in there, and what we think, and also what are the opportunities that you think? What is the leading edge, either computer modeling or the kinds of things that are being done around the world that you're getting a chance to be aware of? And also, what do you want to invest in the rest of the time while you're on the planet? Those are the things that would really, I'd really be curious about if you'll give me another chance to have a conversation.
Dennis, of course I'll give you another chance, but I want to throw something back at you as another possible
Please.
Thing, which I'm very interested in, very involved with right now. Do you know the term rewilding?
No.
Rewilding is the idea of bringing back nature and the things that lived in nature in this country and many others to restore what we used to have to the degree that that's possible. So the idea, very just in brief, because I know this is over, but
what I love about what you're doing is that you are teasing the next episode. So tease it for me. That's perfect.
It's the idea of bringing back mega mammals that still live, maybe not exactly the same species, but hopefully in most cases, to bring them back to where they used to live. So just to give you an example, because it's in sort of a more advanced form in Europe right now, these ideas of bringing back wolves and lynxes as top predators in places where they haven't been seen for hundreds of years, or beavers in Britain, wild cattle, things like this. There's an aspect of fantasy and improbability about it, at least where there's a lot of people, which applies, of course, to Europe, but it is much more likely that we could do something along these lines in North America. And my outstanding target for this is the horse. Horses evolved in North America, disappeared 10,000 years ago. They were reintroduced 500 years ago, but they're regarded as a pest in Bureau of Land Management lands out west for all the wrong reasons. They should be considered a native species. And that's my big thing right now.
So, all right. And
I'll talk about the human adventure, if we can also talk about rewilding, because it has lots of aspects to it that are interesting.
Absolutely. And we'll start right there. Ross, thank you for this time. And I look forward to talking with you the next time very, very soon. Thank you. And be safe. And we'll talk
That's
to you
splendid.
Again.
Thank All you, right. Dennis.
Goodbye.
Good luck.
Bye, Ross.
Stay safe. Bye-bye.